On this week's program, the Philadelphia Orchestra's Glorious Sound of Christmas concerts are now a long-established holiday tradition. We speak with orchestra violinist David Booth about performing in this annual winter celebration. Susan Lewis explores the science in Narnia, an exhibition now at the Franklin Institute. The show is based on C.S. Lewis's classic Narnia Chronicles and recent movie adaptations. Jason Pfeiffer talks to the creator and performers of Cherry Bomb, the worst act in vaudeville, from 1812 productions, and the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns takes us to On Silent Night. The noisy annual holiday parade takes place in more than 20 cities in Philadelphia. That's all I have this morning, Creatively Speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
It's been more than four decades since the Philadelphia Orchestra recorded one of its best-selling albums, The Glorious Sound of Christmas, with Eugene Ormandy. Tonight, the orchestra plays the final concert in an annual series of these seasonal classics, in what has become an annual holiday tradition for the orchestra and its fans. For the musicians, performing such well-known popular holiday music has its own difficulties and rewards. Orchestra violinist David Booth, who as a child listened to the orchestra's recording of The Glorious Sound of Christmas, says the music still engages him personally and professionally.
There's still so much Christmas music that I really love. It's something that I was involved with. My mother was a church organist and pianist, so I grew up and was exposed to it just continuously. And in a way, I think it's impossible to get away from. Plus, this title, The Glorious Sound of Christmas, also reflects on an LP that was one of the two, I believe, million-selling records of the Philadelphia Orchestra. It was very famous. It was also recorded with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, which, of course, during the 60s and early 70s, they were one of the great American super popular, probably the first crossover sort of institution. So that has been a big thing also, especially here in Philadelphia.
Tell me your first recollections of hearing the record. Everybody's heard it at some time, even people who don't know anything about classical music have heard The Glorious Sound of Christmas. What's your first recollection of hearing it?
Well, I come from West Virginia, which is sort of the boondocks, and there was a fair amount of classical music there, and I remember my first exposure to hearing the Philadelphia Orchestra actually were two, possibly three LPs. One was a very famous LP of string pieces that contained the Tchaikovsky Serenade for String, which was my first exposure to that. And of course, I think everybody's, particularly as a string player, a string student, you're just in awe of the sound of the Philadelphia Orchestra strings. I still am today, even as a part of it. And then the other probably two things was this, The Glorious Sound of Christmas, because everybody... That was such a popular crossover thing, and of course, I remember one of the big exposure to music, both classical and otherwise, were these like Columbia and RCA Victor record clubs. I mean, they were very important things at those times. I don't even think they exist anymore, unfortunately. But I remember that a lot of people, including my family, had that The Glorious Sound of Christmas, and also I think which was the other million seller, the famous recording of Messiah.
So if I were to put the gun to your head, is there a favorite? Is there something that you really connect with?
Probably my favorite of all. I never get tired, and I'm still sort of the soaring brilliance, especially the high notes in it, Oh Holy Night. I think that still is just one of the most, the simplicity in it, the way it goes immediately straight to the heart is just, there's nothing quite like it.
And then in performing that, when you're looking out into the audience for one of these Glorious Sound of Christmas concerts, what are you hoping the audience is getting from it? Is it a spiritual experience? Is it just a holiday feeling? What do you want people to take away from it?
Well, the music to me, the thing that I'm most attracted to music is its spirituality. And sort of it's a universal spirituality, not necessarily a religious spirituality. And I find that is one of the most overwhelming aspects of music. And of course, I think the seasonal, the Christmas music, of course, has that more than anything else. And I feel and still get carried away by that as a performer. And I certainly hope that transmits somewhere to the listener.
Final question. A lot of people will be gathered around dinner tables on Christmas Day and over the other holidays that occur at the end of December, listening to The Glorious Sound of Christmas. You play it every year. Does it ever come out of the LP collection, out of the CD collection, and at your table on Christmas?
Yes.
Philadelphia Orchestra violinist David Booth. The orchestra performs The Glorious Sound of Christmas Tonight with conductor Daniel Ratcheff and the Philadelphia Singers Chorale at the Kennel Center's Verizon Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia have become classics in children's literature. The first story, The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, was published in 1950. It and others from the seven-book series have since been adapted for the stage, radio, television, video games and film. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to yet another incarnation of these fantastical tales, a museum exhibition that uses Narnia and recent Hollywood adaptations to teach about science.
Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. This story is about something that happened to them when they were sent away from London during the war because of the air raids.
And so begins The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, a story in which four children push their way through heavy coats and other garments hanging in a seemingly ordinary closet to find themselves in a fantasy world of ice and snow. After the wardrobe, there's a lion named Aslan, and a witch, of course, as well as other talking animals and mythological creatures, a stolen throne, and an enchanted kingdom.
When he was about 16 years old, he had a picture come into his head of a faun in a snowy wood carrying a whole armload of parcels and holding an umbrella.
Douglas Gresham was 8 years old in 1953 when he met C.S. Lewis, whom his mother married 3 years later.
And he just let it go until finally, many years later, he thought, well, I want to try to make a story out of that.
The story sprung those many years later from the mind of a literary scholar known at the time for his writings and talks on the BBC about the rational basis of Christianity.
Most of us can imagine a god attending to any number of claimants if only they come one by one. And he has an endless time to do it. So what's really at the back of the difference...
Born in Belfast in 1898, the younger of two brothers, C.S. Lewis served and was wounded in World War I, then studied English, Greek, and Latin at Oxford. He began teaching at Oxford's Magdalen College in 1925, where he bought a house with his older brother and lived the life of a teacher, writer, and scholar. But Gresham says the trauma of war had further fueled Lewis's imagination.
He was prone to nightmares ever after his experiences in the First World War, but on this occasion he was dreaming about a huge lion, and as he said afterwards, Aslan leapt into the story and dragged all the rest of Narnia with him.
And so began a midlife journey for Clive Staples Lewis, or, to those who knew him, Jack. He was encouraged to write the stories, says Gresham, from conversations with his friend J.R.R., or Ron, Tolkien, who himself would go on to write The Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings books.
They both were very concerned that no one at that time, and we're talking about the 1940s now, was writing children's literature that, A, they would have wanted to have read themselves when they were children, or B, children's literature the way it should be written. And so they both decided they'd have a bash at it themselves.
The way it should be written?
Jack realized, I think, probably that he had something valuable to give children in the way of showing them how honor and duty and courage and loyalty and commitment and personal responsibility are so valuable to individuals and how much we need them.
The books became modern classics, shared with each new wave of young readers. Radio and television productions followed. And then in 2005, the feature film The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was released. Prince Caspian came out last May. Co-producer Gresham says contemporary technology could finally do justice to the mythological creatures on the screen.
From my early teens, and probably earlier than that, I've always thought that the Narnian Chronicles would each make fabulous films, if only we had the technology to do them justice, where we could really do justice to characters like Aslan, for example.
I don't think that Narnia could have been made probably 10 years ago without the great visual effects people that we have around now.
Michael Flaherty is president of Walden Media, which partnered with Disney in the making of the Narnia movies, the costumes, set designs, and music of which are used in the exhibition now at the Franklin Institute. Was the museum show created to market the movie? Michael Flaherty says no, it was the other way around. The movie was conceived as a tool to stimulate learning, based on an idea put forth decades ago by one of America's greatest scientific minds.
Thomas Edison predicted back in the 20s that the motion picture would replace the textbooks because he saw enormous capability in the medium to teach kids.
Flaherty was intrigued by the same possibilities in 2001 during his volunteer experiences teaching urban kids in Boston.
And what I had noticed was that after kids had seen the movie Titanic, it caused them to try to learn a lot more. They got books out of the library, they went to museum exhibits, and they really started to empathize with those people.
Walden Media says Flaherty aims to promote this kind of learning and has made films from stories such as Charlotte's Web and Holes focused on literacy. The Chronicles of Narnia, in turn, have lots of teaching moments, says Eddie Newquist, president of Creative and Exhibitions for the Becker Group, which produced the exhibition. He points to scientific ideas woven throughout the narrative.
He inserts things like people controlling weather and affecting weather like the White Witch. He talks a lot about treating nature kindly and being careful not to destroy the forest. He also loved time travel, the whole idea that the children can go through this wardrobe into Narnia, but a day may have passed for them, or even a minute in their time, but 1,000 years may have passed in Narnia.
You will now have the chance to explore the world of Narnia.
The museum show juxtaposes real life with fantasy. Its first section is a room devoted to the author, including his letters and personal effects. Then wardrobe-like doors open on cue. The highlights of Narnia are recreated, starting with falling snow. Science themes are explored alongside story details that give rise to them.
And now you have to learn why it's cold all the time. You have to learn about the animals and the creatures, so it's your opportunity to explore it, and you learn things along the way.
Visitors can sit in the White Witch's throne or duck into the hollow of a tree where truffle hunters live. Along the journey are interactive lessons like icy walls that melt at the touch and a catapult that really works.
There you go. That's all you do.
Great job.
Franklin Institute President and CEO Dennis Wendt says the show is a way of reaching out to people who might not otherwise be drawn to science.
It's another way of communicating science and important environmental and science messages, like animal adaptation and environmental change.
And while Benjamin Franklin never read the books or saw the movies, the exhibition aims to stimulate a human drive the philosophical politician, printer, and inventor knew well.
Franklin was unique because of his extraordinary sense of curiosity. He saw the world as other people saw it, but he understood it in a way that was different. One of our goals is to create opportunities for people to be really curious.
And C.S. Lewis?
I think that he'd be rather thrilled and rather amused to think Narnia itself would take place in a science museum linked in with science. And I'll tell you another thing. I think that if Ben Franklin and my stepfather had met, I think they would have become good friends.
How did Franklin's mind move from life in 18th century Philadelphia to the idea of bifocals or a lightning rod or the glass harmonica? Why do some of us see a wardrobe as a place to hang clothes and others as a door to fantastical adventure? The legacies of C.S. Lewis and Benjamin Franklin may be rightly intertwined. Both looked at what was right in front of them and saw a world beyond.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Chronicles of Narnia, the exhibition, is at the Franklin Institute through April 19th. For nearly a decade, Philadelphia's 1812 Productions has created an annual holiday show. Each year, the seasonal production represents a different slice of comedic history, ranging from vintage vaudeville sketches to mid-20th century nightclub comedy tributes. This year, the tradition continues with a new musical that considers the odd legacy of Five Sisters from Iowa. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, it may very well be among the worst acts of the year.
Cherry Bomb, the worst act in vaudeville for the holidays, is based on the Cherry Sisters. Addie, Effie, Ella, Lizzie, and Jessie Cherry formed a touring act in the late 1800s, often playing to sold-out houses. Jennifer Childs, 1812's artistic director and Cherry Bomb creator, says the sisters were renowned for their lack of talent.
Legend has it that they were so dreadful that people threw tomatoes and cabbage and fruit and vegetables at them, and that they had to perform behind a screen to keep themselves from being harmed by the onslaught of produce.
If there's a lesson to teach, it's do not overreach, risk nothing, and you will be fine.
The 1812 production's musical tells its story through nine acts, assuming the structure of a vaudeville billing. These variety shows, popular in the late 1800s and early 1900s, consisted of seemingly unrelated acts that showcased different skills and styles: singing, dancing, juggling, comedy, drama, and novelty routines. The Cherry Sisters initially performed in their hometown of Marion, Iowa, and then took their act onto the vaudeville circuit. An influential theater producer, Oscar Hammerstein I, the grandfather of you-know-who, eventually brought them to New York City. Their headliner act, Something Good, Something Sad, included original songs, dances, essay recitations, and skits. The work had strong moral themes about sobriety and proper living, reflecting the sisters' own rigid discipline and high standards of decency. Mary McCool, who plays Effie in Cherry Bomb, believes in the context of the vaudeville scene, the sisters were innovative.
Because at the time, you know, there were animal acts and silly things and people, you know, showing their stockings and legs. And these women were not into that at all. They were doing something that no one was doing on the stage, which was reciting essays and uplifting the moral character of the audience.
Audiences were fascinated by the Cherry Sisters, but not so much with the women's skills or their morality lessons. Instead, it was their lack of talent that was compelling. Jennifer Childs says similar acts can be found in contemporary culture, in TV programs like The Gong Show and American Idol.
Reality TV is our version of the Cherry Sisters, this kind of love-hate, repulse-attract relationship that we have.
Though it drew crowds and was renowned for being so bad it's good, the Cherry Sisters act had its detractors. In fact, the sisters sued newspaper critics twice over reviews that excoriated their performance and ridiculed them, using descriptions like the Four Freaks from Iowa. One of the lawsuits, which the sisters lost, went all the way to the Iowa Supreme Court. It's considered a landmark case, helping to establish the press's right to fair comment and criticism. According to director Jennifer Childs, the story of the Cherry Sisters, and reality television for that matter, raises fascinating questions about the relationship between an audience and a performer.
How do you make something so bad that you really provoke people to throw things at you? What do we get out of watching people do bad work? Why do we tune in every week? Why did people come see the Cherry Sisters, you know?
These aren't easy questions to answer, but Mary Martello, who plays Ella in Cherry Bomb, reasons that a high level of self-confidence might be part of the explanation, not unlike Martello's childhood memory of putting on a circus with the neighborhood kids.
We did all kinds of things that we really couldn't do. And we were just completely confident in our own ability to put on this show. And I'm beginning more and more to think that these sisters just have this kind of natural confidence and belief in themselves, and that what they love and what they enjoy and what they discover they can do, surely the whole world will be as entranced as they are.
Confidence on the part of the 1812 performers also comes into play for Cherry Bomb. Mary McCool says it took some time to become comfortable with intentionally performing badly.
We had a workshop in June where we were just exploring, you know, who we were as characters. We were exploring the whole idea of being bad. And it was so hard at first. I mean, it would actually make me blush, and like my body would sort of physically revolt against allowing myself, you know, these extravagances as a performer that, you know, all my training has sort of cleaned away.
Perhaps the most looming question about the Cherry Sisters is, did they truly believe they were good performers, or were they just remarkably oblivious? Jennifer Childs says, based on her research from resources like the Iowa Historical Society, which has a Cherry Sisters collection of journals, letters, songs, and poems, she doesn't believe they did know they lacked talent.
I think they believed and maintained till their deaths that they were good but misunderstood. However, they were also not stupid. They knew that what they were doing was making them money. I think at the time it was like, when we do this, people may throw things at us, but we get paid and we get booked different places. So, I don't know, if you ask me, you can't go through 10 years of having stuff thrown at you and not go, huh, I think Maybe I'm not that great.
Child says no recordings of the Cherry Sisters have survived the century. So, it's difficult to fully comprehend how truly bad they were. Yet the fact that they have left a continuing legacy of a historical society collection, a landmark court case, and now a new musical from 1812 Productions, suggests that on some level, these determined women were doing something right.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Cherry Bomb, the worst act of vaudeville from 1812 Productions, is at the Plays and Players Theatre in Philadelphia through January 4th. What was once considered an avant-garde happening exclusive to ultra-artsy circles has now become a family Christmas tradition in Philadelphia. Though light years beyond Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, Phil Klein's Unsilent Night may be a classic in the making. The piece consists of ambient music tapes played on 50 or so portable stereos in a procession through Center City, and was put on by Philadelphia's Relash Ensemble for the sixth consecutive year on Monday, ambushing shoppers on Walnut Street, getting in the way of joggers, and prompting the inevitable question, what is it and what is it for? The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns now reports from the front.
It's an unsilent night in Rittenhouse Square. Typically, that means pulsating pop music coming from SUVs with New Jersey license plates. This time, it's 50 or so boomboxes generating ambient music. The crowd, about 100 people or so, maybe 200. Many wore Santa hats. Some brought their children, some brought their dogs. One person did an interpretive dance.
Thank you very much. You're the best band I've ever been in. And please, everybody come and join Relash for a little after party upstairs. And one way or another, I hope to see you again next year.
Thank you. Thanks again, Phil.
However pleasurable the experience was, it's not like the Nutcracker when you can point to the fantastical costumes as your source of enjoyment. Even seasoned musicians like cellist Ulrich Buchheller, who heard it for the first time on Monday, and composer Andrea Clearfield, who has come nearly every year since it started here, had trouble defining the experience and in a way didn't really want to.
I love to just be inside the sound without having to make it myself. And just sort of being in this very meditative state.
But in a way, we are performing it. Because I experimented with holding the box in different places,
yes,
up and down to
true.
The side,
yep.
So that I could experience the sound coming from different angles.
Yes.
The bystanders that I talked to said, what's the motivation?
Mm-hmm. This is totally besides the point. I mean, that was the wonderful thing, that it's a happening, that you're inside the experience, mm-hmm. and there's an element of timelessness, you know, which is totally the non-utilitarian aspect of it, I think, is just the most wonderful thing about it.
You think of music as many purposes, and one of them is to create joy. I mean,
right,
very
yes.
simply, you
right.
know, to touch the soul.
The mechanism of Unsilent Night, which was composed by New York-based Phil Klein, is simple. Word gets out in newspaper squibs or email blasts to meet at a certain place and time, no reservations or tickets, BYO Boombox. You're loaned a tape or CD containing one of four ambient music tracks that interact with each other a bit like Renaissance polyphonic choral music, except the interaction of the different tracks isn't strictly synchronized, and doesn't have to be. Among the many sources Phil Klein drew on for Unsilent Night is a Martin Luther hymn that was sung by a boy soprano.
In this particular piece, I chose a drone to go under it, and I had the Luther melody being sung by the boy treble. And then I had that transposed into several different keys, playing against itself. And then I sort of freely improvised with it.
On
you know,
what, though?
I was using synthesizers, keyboards, you know. It was all going in a computer and audio, you know, so that it could be manipulated. Although I really didn't do too... This particular section is not very dense. There's just, you know, the boy times, you know, four of the boy... And the drone, and then sort of a free descant going over the drone, and then some bells that were added.
No parade permit was needed, since nobody congregated, As we started out from Rittenhouse Square, headed east on Walnut, looped around 15th Street and back at the Kimmel Center, and then west to Rittenhouse Square, all in about 45 minutes. It was as if the circus had come to town, though one heard more than seen. Many bystanders seemed to unconsciously decide that if they couldn't understand the processional, it didn't exist. But that wasn't everybody. One of the city's meter maids stopped in the middle of giving out parking tickets.
Oh, I like that music!
Really?
Yes, it's very nice!
The New York Times called Unsilent Night an experience of suspended wonderment. Thaddeus Squire, who originally brought Unsilent Night to Philadelphia, has called it an experiment in social engineering. Whatever it is, the tradition began in downtown Manhattan as Klein composed and revised the piece throughout much of the 1990s. It has become so popular there that it's going underground again. He stopped advertising it because crowds swelled into the thousands and became unwieldy. This popularity may be unprecedented in the history of conceptual art, that obscure cerebral movement in the 1960s, when artists created pieces based on an abstract, hopefully poetic idea, like a cellist bowing a chunk of ice until it melts. Unsilent Night is more practical and less messy.
You know, that's the one place where I have great pride is that Unsilent Night is a conceptual piece that can be performed by any number of amateur, you know, you don't have to be a skilled musician, you don't need an audience, you don't need a theater, and all you need is the tapes.
Klein has since gone on to compose important, though somewhat more traditional works. The Kimmel Center's Fresh Ink series devoted an entire concert to his works, which include musical settings of words by Hunter Thompson, Vietnam War soldiers, and some of the more circular speeches of former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. Yet Klein returns to Unsilent Night every year. It's performed in 25 cities and in places as far away as the warm weather Christmases in Australia. Once he finishes all the administration work, consider all the tapes and CDs that have to be coordinated, he takes to the street and is particularly happy when the crowd has a mind of its own.
Ah, there. That's the proper urban guerrilla spirit there.
What?
Oh, they're just coming across in a way.
He doesn't go to all performances. The 50-something composer has a wife, as well as a 14-month-old daughter who has already slept through two Unsilent Nights. But he's experienced his piece in San Francisco in a driving rainstorm with participants who hardly seem to notice, as well as in New Haven, wading through a foot of snow. So often, Klein is told that Unsilent Night is perfectly suited to cities he hardly knows and has never visited. In a certain transcendental way, Unsilent Night becomes what the city needs. The music first confronts an unsuspecting population psychologically with the eternal what is it for question, and then plays off the sound qualities of the passing architecture. In effect, Unsilent Night plays a city in a way that a great virtuoso plays a violin.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.